Hey, welcome everyone to this weekend's episode of Nevada Backcountry. New show sponsor, Alert Shooting Performance Institute. I was just at one of their long-range courses with Jim Irwin and crew this last weekend. So we'll touch on that course coming up a little bit on the show, but you got some commission meeting notes we need to get to, Dave.
Yeah, no, we have the agenda out for the next Wildlife Commission. It is going to be here in Reno at Sierra Center Parkway. It'll be next week. It's November 15th and November 16th.
Is that a Friday-Saturday deal?
It's a Friday-Saturday deal. It's a pretty good agenda. It's got the standard stuff. I'm just going to hit on some of the things I think folks might like to hear about. They've got the sagebrush habitat plan. It's going to be presented and discussed, some of the rehabilitation on sagebrush habitat. There will also be a report on our response to the chronic wasting disease.
At
the beginning of the season, we had that.
We had those
deer with chronic wasting in California just right on our border. Department of Wildlife went into a response with getting people to bring animals in for CWD checks and stuff.
How's
like
that gone so far? Do you know?
It's gone very well. The Department of Wildlife vet, Dr. Nate Leloux, he is going to be presenting on our response and probably answer some questions in relation to any possible test results that may be out there at this point in time. That'll be a cool one. Now, this stuff is all on Friday the 15th, and it starts at 8:30 in the morning. And then we get into the Cave Creek Dam rehabilitation. I know a lot of folks have been kind of following this.
Yeah.
So the Cave Creek. So that's going to be a conversation, a little talk on that. Then there will be several wildlife reports going on with our several administrators, just discussing some of the wildfire season. So that'll be a presentation by our habitat administrator. So that'll be really cool.
Hey, knock on wood.
We've been really, really lucky this year compared to Oregon and Idaho.
Yep.
And I think California is just, because it's hell, it's just burning a lot more than anywhere else. But so we've been super fortunate. So let's cross our fingers and
we're almost out of it. I mean, the weather's changing and
you
get those fall thunderstorms, but for the most part, by this point, sitting here end of October, we've been fortunate.
Super fortunate. I'm going to leave it at that, so I don't jinx anything.
Yep.
And have people sit there like, you jerk, you jinxed us. There's going to be a conversation, a topic on emerging technology, which is going to be related to law enforcement. There's a lot of cool new technology going out there for monitoring and
is this like the drone thing we talked about with policing up shed hunters out of
stuff like that? And there's some other stuff, there's some other technology that'll all be discussed, kind of some of the new technology coming out, which I think would be really cool. There will also be a biodiversity division overview, kind of explaining that whole division, which will be really cool for folks that are into some of the non-game stuff. There will be a discussion on Mr. Curtis. James Curtis is appealing his
his
penalty or his having his license and hunting and fishing and trapping license revoked for 5 years.
Which way is the wind blowing on that one?
You know, I'm not really sure. I know, you know, it's pretty tough to get those reversed.
Right.
You know, especially if there's a lot of evidence to prove that you were a bad boy in the field.
Yeah. If there's any validity to some of the initial stuff, it was pretty flagrant.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's just like any court deal. I mean, you can appeal anything. Depends on how many times you want to cut a check to an attorney. So that'll be pretty much the end of the day once, Friday, the November 15th. Then we'll get into Saturday, which will again start at 8:30 in the morning. If anyone wants to come down, you can also view it online on the NDAO website. There will be a link there to watch it online if you like to, with your morning coffee.
And that includes the link to submit questions.
Oh,
right?
Once you log in, then you'll have an option. There's like a little chat tab.
And you can hit
the chat tab and type in your question, and then the person monitoring all of the internet viewers will see your question pop up, and then they can present it. So Saturday will be pretty cool. There is Policy 67 is going to be discussed. That's the horse and burro update. They'll be giving us a statewide assessment and presentation on the horse and burro captures and conditions.
Yeah, you know how I feel about that, so I'm not going to get on my soapbox.
I know, same here. Another one would be the Predator Management Report. They'll be working with the USGS dealing with Project 41, which is the common raven concerns and the densities for common raven effects on like sage grouse, nesting sage grouse, the eggs, and that'll be a topic.
Pause right there real quick. Are ravens similar to crows? Because I know crows will wreak havoc on duck populations.
Yeah, same with
thing.
Ravens.
And you cannot, like crows, you can shoot 20-something a day during the season, and you just have to remove the carcasses.
Yeah, you can't touch ravens.
Ravens are federally, right?
Yeah, you can't touch ravens. So whole different control program there. So, and then after that, you'll get into some of the workshops and public comments. So you'll have Commission Regulation 2414, which is the falconry regulations. They'll be discussing the 24 and 25 season, you know, when, so that you know, some of the falconers go out and they'll get new birds.
Right,
so there's a season for that and a permit that they have to acquire. So they'll be talking about the seasons, the species you can acquire, the quotas, and the timeline and the limits. So,
okay.
So that'll be kind of cool. Because I know the state of Nevada, there's a special permitting for master falconers to actually be put into almost like a lottery. Well, it is a lottery to actually have a eagle now.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, there was a falconer in Reno that was luckily got his name pulled last year from the slot and was able to acquire I think he acquired a golden eagle.
You got to be kidding me.
No.
Whoa.
No, how cool would that be, huh? Cruising around with a golden eagle on your arm?
40-inch tall.
Yeah,
the thing's
right?
Like Lord.
You're going to build up some lats on that one, holding that thing up. But
hey,
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty slick. So that's an important regulation for the falconers. You'll probably have quite a few there.
Okay.
The next one would be the non-commercial collection of reptiles. So like every little kid's favorite thing in the world, go out and grab lizards, stick them in their pockets and bring them home, show mom and dad. This is just talking about the non-commercial collection. Again, it's going to be talking about seasons and limits and the species that you can go and pick up.
Are Western fence lizards on there?
Dude, yeah, you can grab those all day long.
Okay, because I was going
to
say.
That was the lizard to get when you were a kid. I mean.
You've been to my place. Rocks, there are thousands of them.
Oh, man, same with my place. That's as kids, we'd go down, hit the rock piles and just catch lizards and stick them in our pockets and then go home and we would see who caught the biggest, just a typical boy thing. And one of the big ones that has been on the docket for a while is the Regulation 522 is the E-tag regulation.
Oh,
so
gotcha.
That one is going to be up for actual discussion and possible vote to have it changed or amended in our Chapter 502 Nevada Administrative Code to allow for electronic tags. Because right now it states you have to have the paper tag on your person while you're hunting and be able to present it. Now it'll be, you know, have the option of a e-tag. So that one's kind of cool. It's kind of catching up with.
I'll be interested to hear. Let's see. So this would be Saturday the 16th?
This will be Saturday the 16th conversation. This is like topic number 21A.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. We've raised some concerns on the show.
Yeah, I mean, I've still got some, like, you know, because in the statute of code, it talks about how, you know, you have to have that paper one. Then once you harvest your animal, it has
attached
to
the largest,
to be
part,
the
of
largest
the
part of the carcass. So how, you just duct taped your phone to the carcass? I mean, how does that work? That kind of a deal. I'm sure that's figured out, but it'll be interesting to hear how that plays out. The next one is another administrative regulation to change or to amend Chapter 501 of our administrative code, and this is Regulation 523, not to be mistaken with 522.
Oh, good. I was confused.
Yeah, no. It's one up from
one
it.
More?
One more.
Okay.
So it's going to be talking about the heritage grants, the heritage funds.
Oh, right.
When they're distributing those out for people that apply for them, just extending it from, usually it's an annual grant cycle, and it still will be, but when you apply for it, instead of having to apply every year to maintain your funds or to finish your project, it'll allow it to go out to 2 years. Some pretty cool stuff. The rest of the commission is just updates and division public comment stuff.
Okay. So let's take a pause there. I got a question. When we come back on Nevada Backcountry, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Hey, welcome back to Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Over the break there, Dave, we were just talking about the commission meeting notes, and there's nothing about the mountain lion trapping deal that we talked about last weekend.
Yeah, no, not in this particular commission. So I was kind of anticipating it being on this commission docket.
I thought this was going to land.
Yeah, but I'm taking a stab at, in the dark here, but I'm assuming that it got sent back for some revisions.
Yeah, there was a lot of goofy stuff on there.
Yeah, there was a lot of goofy stuff that didn't really make a lot of sense, and sometimes it seemed like it almost contradicted itself. So
we'll keep everybody posted on that as that develops, because it's not this upcoming one. Man, now let's switch gears. Shooting Performance Institute, Jim Irwin. We've had him on the show a couple times now. I was fortunate enough to take part in his long-range shooting course last weekend. So we're going to do kind of a review, an information dump, if you will, on things I picked up. Let's see, where do I want to go first?
Were there requirements that you had to bring? Or
gear stuff?
Yeah, gear stuff, or even like physical stuff. Like,
No physical stuff. No. In fact, a listener of 99.1 was one of the participants in the class, heard the ads, signed up. He had I don't know if it was a disability, but he had something with his neck and back. So they accommodated him, and he actually shot off of one of those big tripod things.
Oh, okay.
So he could sit and shoot, and was a hell of a shot, too.
Nice.
So there were no physical requirements. There was like a, I'll call it a packing list.
You know, things that you had to bring.
Yeah, as far as bring a rifle, your bags, 80 to 100 rounds of match-grade ammunition, a notebook, you know, that little stuff.
Yeah.
Outside of that, no, there weren't any physical things. The first day was interesting. It was a good brush up, but it went over fundamentals. It was mostly classroom stuff. So fundamentals, rifle setup, scope setup, ammunition, all of that. It's like drinking from a fire hose.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, there's a lot that he covers. And then the end of day one, you actually go out and you confirm zero or get a good 100-yard zero on your rifle. And that kind of concludes
day one.
That's day one.
So you get to shoot on day one, but it's just dialing in 100 yards.
100 yards, and then they have you shoot through a chronograph. So you know the true velocity of your bullet coming out of the barrel, not what's printed on the box or online or whatever.
Right.
So what was interesting, I was shooting a 7 PRC. I was a full...
And this is the gun you're taking to Canada for your moose.
And that's why I took it, because I want to be 100% confident if a moose steps out across a bog at like 500 and some odd yards, I know exactly what my setup is going to do. I'm taking the same ammo. I was the outlier. Most guys did show up with like a match, like a target ammo. I showed up with my hunting ammo. Now, I held my own on day two with it.
Yeah.
But I was shooting the Hornady Precision Hunter 7 PRC factory loads. I didn't have time to work up a load or anything, hand load stuff.
That seems like a lot of work, though, man. When you start dabbling in, doing your own...
Reloading
and stuff. I know Pat does it and he digs it. That's like his jam. He just sits in his house in dark place drinking wine and loading bullets. But
yeah. Oh, I got a good anecdote on that too.
Yeah, it just seems like a lot of work.
So I reload. It just takes time. And here's the thing about it, right? If you're going to set up, get everything dialed and reload, like for this course, 100 rounds. Man, you're talking about a good chunk of your day, and it's not something that you can like pause in the middle of and be like, oh yeah, let's go to lunch or let me mow the lawn and then I'll come back to it.
Yeah.
Everything that static and all that with the, like I use an automatic powder dispenser, unless you're willing to full stop, put everything away, get it back out, recalibrate everything and set up again. It's not something you can just take a pause in the middle of. And as we found out, my dad brought some reloads and was having a heck of a time with them. And I don't know where in the process something went sideways on him. He was really struggling with the hand loads at first. The spotter that was assigned to us said, hey, Jerry, stop with the hand loads. Do you have factory ammunition? Luckily, my dad had factory ammunition. All of a sudden, he made the switch, and it was like shooting a bug hole at 100, and then first-round impacts out the course. So something went wrong. I know he and I have gone back and forth over the years on warming up his scale. With those digital powder dispensers, you're supposed to let them warm up. You go through this whole process. I think he's of the mindset that it's a waste of time, but as we saw, it might not be a waste of time. Something was off with his hand loads.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's a quick anecdote on that. But day two of the course, you go out to Smith Valley and they've got a full out to a mile, a shooting course out there.
So how many yards is that? A mile?
1,760.
Okay, I was close. 1,700. Yeah. 1,760 yards.
Correct. Yes. And I was fortunate enough, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I managed to put two rounds back to back.
That's amazing.
On steel at a mile.
That's insane. That's amazing.
With a sub 8-pound, 22-inch barrel hunting rifle with a 3-10 scope on it. There were guys out there with those like 32 power scopes and chassis guns.
You know, the competitive long distance shooters that are.
Yep. So let me back up real quick, because day one, you do your 100-yard zero.
Yeah.
That's kind of the end. Then you go back, you plug all of that, your muzzle velocity, all your bullet information into a Kestrel, like a little wind meter thing environmental meter. Anyway, that gives you your theoretical data. Like, well, at 700 yards, this should be your come up or how far, how many clicks you got to put into your scope. So you do all that theoretical stuff. You write it all down. Day two, you go out to Smith Valley. They've got an amazing little bowl back out in the mountains. It's a ways out there, but they've got targets hung all the way out to a mile.
Is it along the river there, along the Walker River?
No,
Desert Creek.
No, it's going north. So you would go into Wellington.
Okay, Wellington.
And then cut north.
And then go north. Oh, yep. Okay. Instead of coming, okay, you just keep that, stay on that same road and go.
Yeah, you go lower
north.
Colony Road
the heck out there. Yep. Okay.
So that's where it was. And it was interesting. Here's my takeaway for people listening. First off, if you can afford to do so, absolutely take the course. This was my profession for a large chunk of my 20s. Then time, money, life happens. It was a phenomenal refresher for me. I got a ton out of it. I would recommend anybody that has not done this stuff to sign up and do the course. You will learn so much about your capabilities as a shooter, your rifle capabilities, everything. So day two, you start at 200. They say, okay, this is what your theoretical data was. You put those clicks into the scope. You shoot, either impact, no impact, what went wrong, et cetera. And they're fine-tuning your form along the way, too. There was stuff even I was screwing up as far as I wasn't coming up high enough and my trigger pull was a little off to the side. So my round started tracking to the right as a right-handed shooter.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of like archery, if you're a finger shooter and you two tucked in there and you start plucking it and you start rolling the string and you start shooting left or right. You canting kind of relates, but.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, and the spotters are phenomenal. It's basically Jim and his crew of like two other guys that are all super long range nerds. One of the guys, Dave, I think his name was, they call him like the king of the 1 mile. Cause that's his jam, is the extreme long range stuff.
Oh my gosh.
But you shoot out, you confirm everything. Here's the takeaway for listeners. and I'm going to leave you with a cliffhanger. We're going to go to break.
All right.
And when we come back, I will give the listeners my takeaway for your average hunter from the long range shooting course I took with Shooting Performance Institute, and quick tease. Thank you to Battleborn Tree Service for sponsoring the show. The show is actually going to end with a segment recorded. My dad sat down with Mike to talk about that elk hunt. Green score, I said 389. It's actually over 400 inches.
Jeez.
So that's how the show will end today. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. And we're back on Nevada Backcountry. Thank you to Legacy Sports International for sponsoring the show. If you miss a segment of the show, you can always go to 991fmtalk.com. Click on the podcast tab. All past episodes are up there. Or if you miss like the first segment of a show, you want to catch up afterwards, by all means, go listen there. Now, we left on a cliffhanger, Dave.
Yes, we did.
We're going to get to that right off the bat, because otherwise, squirrel.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We'll move on.
Yeah. Well.
So my takeaway from the course, I'm shooting a 7 PRC. It's a fast round. I'm shooting a heavy for caliber bullet. It's environmentals defeating, meaning it's got a high ballistic coefficient. It tracks pretty true. It beats a little bit of wind, not a ton of drift on it, not a ton of drop. Regardless of that, 700 yards is what I would say, just watching the class and watching people shoot. And some of these guys compete in that PRS and, you know, the like long range competition stuff.
Yeah.
700 yards is about where the wheels start coming off.
For everybody.
For everybody. And here's, it doesn't matter how good a shooter you are, how dialed your setup is, environmentals take over at that point. Meaning like wind, vortexes, shifts in pressure.
Like humidity and everything just kind of plays.
Everything starts to play a part at 700 and beyond. So we're talking over the break. I was super fortunate. I actually, and kudos to my spotter, the guy that was assigned to my dad and I,
yeah.
They pair you up and give you a spotter. He was great about, okay, we've got, you know, this tumbling wind here. We've got a vortex at 3. So I need you to add so many mils or minutes of angle when you take this shot. And I, knock on wood, I was good out to 1,000. I did miss at a mile. And then all it was just environmentals shifted. I sent my shot and they said, whoa, hold on. The wind just shifted. And sure enough, I missed left. And then rounds were on target. But time of flight, you're talking about like over a second of time of flight.
Yeah.
At a mile. So it's like you shoot 1,000, 2, bing, and then you get the hit. So every little thing beyond 700, as far as wind, pressure, all that, is where that comes into play. The reason I bring that up is because it's the current push in hunting, right? Like the long range.
Oh, yeah.
Shot them at 1,100. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say it. You got lucky, because if there's a wind shift, if there's a change in whatever, it doesn't matter how good you or your setup are, it's going to knock your bullet off course.
Yeah.
So 90+% of the class, that was my big takeaway.
Was 700.
700
was
and beyond is where the wheels started coming off.
Is that because the bullet's slowing down?
Yep.
Is it, I mean, obviously you said it's environmental factors, but
yep.
Is it because the bullet's starting to slow down and now environmental factors have a greater effect on it?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And so like even at 600, I wound up, I think my first round hit like 3 or 4 inches. They have like 12 inch steel gongs, and my round hit like 3-4 inches low and left with the way the wind was swirling.
Yeah.
And that was at 600 yards. Now, if I was aiming in the right place, that would still be a kill on like an elk or a moose. However, it also could have been right in that shoulder socket, and I could have wound up, if I was aiming for that crease,
yeah,
I'd have a leg shot critter.
Chasing that for days.
So, like I said, that was my big interesting takeaway from the whole thing was, man, 700 and in, even if you're super dialed, okay, 700's pushing it. Beyond that, like 800 to 1,000 and beyond, man, you better have a good spotter. And everybody, Jim's been on the show. Everybody knows Jim's background.
Yeah.
He's probably one of the top 10 spotters in the country, if not the world. And guys were still hitting off or missing just because of the environment.
Wow. With all of this, you've been to the course, you've gone through it, you hit the gong at a mile, which to me is amazing. I don't even think I'd be able to see this, the darn thing at 700, let alone another 1,000 yards.
You could, yeah.
But the takeaway for you now you're going to be heading to Canada to go shoot a couple variations of critters.
Yep.
With the knowledge you have, what is your max now? Now that you've done all of this, what would you say would be your max distance you would feel comfortable with a good, solid, humane kill on an
animal?
One and done.
Yeah.
And a decent retrieval.
You want the mealy mouth dancer?
Sure.
Situation dependent.
Okay.
So let's say I'm prone. I'm on a bipod.
Yeah.
Guns
like things
perfectly
are great.
Leveled.
Like things are awesome.
No wind, no nothing.
Yeah.
700 and in.
700, so you're going to stop at that 700-yard range and bring it in from there. Kind of like archery where, we'll take on an animal, we'll take an 80, 85-yard shot, but
situation.
Animal has to be in a certain position. Animal has to...
Am I canted over rocks?
Right. Animal can't be sitting there staring at you.
Right.
No wind, that kind of stuff. If any of those elements are in play, you don't.
I've got the rifle against a tree.
Yeah.
And now you got like a 13 mile per hour crosswind.
Yeah. So you're dropping that down to like 400.
Yards. Yeah. Gotcha. Maybe 450-ish. But that was where, even with the environmentals out there, out to like 500, because of that high ballistic coefficient bullet, the speed it's coming out, it bucks the wind. It tracks true out to about 500. Beyond that, it's going slow enough that the environmentals start to really come into play.
Okay.
So if I'm standing offhand, man, maybe 200.
Yeah.
Knock it, divide that again. You know, I mean, that's the mealy mouth dancer.
Right, right. Because like on my antelope hunt, you and I went shooting.
You helped
me out, got me dialed in a bit. I wasn't comfortable beyond 300. Even with the tripod and having good stability, I was like, 300 and in is my spot right now because I'm not proficient enough yet to reach out there, you know, at the 400, 500, and 600-yard range.
So here's something that was interesting to me because they had I believe it was a 50-inch or a 4-foot steel plate, 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet. And I thought, boy, that's a really big plate out there at a mile. But think about this, and this is where you start to think about the capabilities of your setup. So I'm shooting what I will call a half-minute gun, meaning for all intents and purposes, at 100 yards, 3 shots go within a half-inch group. It's a high-end, super accurate rifle.
Right.
If it's a half-minute gun, even at 1,000, 1 minute of angle will take off the .047, just call it an inch. 1 minute at 1,000 yards is 10 inches. So theoretically, the best my gun can shoot is a 5-inch group at 1,000 yards. Now let's say you're running, don't take this personally, Dave, but let's say you're running Remington core locked.
Best bullet ever. Best bullet ever.
Yeah, and you know, maybe you've only got like 20 rounds through the gun. It's not a super settled and stable barrel yet.
Yeah.
And you're shooting like 2-inch groups. So you got a 2-minute gun at 100 yards.
Oh, okay. I see where you're going.
Now take that to 1,000. The best you are going to do is a 20-inch group at 1,000.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter. Again, this is where guys get their egos wrapped up in it. And it's like you'll see guys shoot and they're like, it's good enough. And it's a 3-inch group at 100. Man, you're talking about a 12-inch group at 400.
Yeah, that's not good.
Uh-uh. So that's where that equipment component really comes into play. And the reason they had such a big plate at a mile, because you're talking about 176 inches. So let's say you can shoot an inch group at 100. Now you're shooting a 176-inch group at a mile, and you're trying to hit a 48-inch plate. That's where that equipment comes into play. That is going to do it for Dave and I. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned, because coming up, we've got Mike from Battleborn Tree Service and Jerry Evans sitting down to talk about Mike's 400-plus-inch bull he took with a bow. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.
Well, thank you, Henry and Dave. We're going to take over Nevada Backcountry for just a couple of minutes. I want to talk to one of the sponsors of Nevada Backcountry, who got one of those coveted bull elk tags in unit number, what was it, Mike?
Unit 162, Table Mountain Wilderness.
Okay, and that's Mike Orlick that you just heard, Battleborn Tree Service, one of the sponsors of Nevada Backcountry. First of all, how long have you been bow hunting?
About 10 years.
10 years, and then how long had you been putting in for a bull elk tag in Nevada?
I think I had 8 points plus my admission this year, so that would have been 9.
So 9 points to finally get that tag. He didn't just get the tag. He got the bull of a lifetime. We'll get to that in a moment, but building up to that. So first of all, you went out scouting, I know. How many days did you scout?
We went in July, August, and September, three different times, about 3 days each time, just hiking around, getting to know our water sources and the elevation, and hopefully to see elk. And we didn't even see any elk until September.
Your season, though, it was the archery season. What day did it start?
It was September 17th was opening day.
So were they bugling then?
Really good the opening morning, and really, really good about 3 days after opening morning.
Okay, so around the 20th, they were bugling, and so you were obviously hearing them and starting to see elk that you didn't see prior to September anyway, right?
Yes, they finally were coming out of the trees and hanging out in the open, and a few times sounded like we were completely surrounded by them.
I was hunting the exact same time, but for a cow elk. So your elk, season started on the 17th, and you took it on what day?
I believe the 24th.
So you were in there for a week. You stayed there after the season opened to hunt, right?
Yes, sir.
Tell me what happened.
Well, we had some good chances at bulls the opening couple mornings. Actually took 2 shots at a bull, and one was in very dense aspen forest and hit some branches on the way in and deflected my shot. And the other one didn't work out as well.
What about the bulls? Were you going for as big as you could get, or were you being patient? The bulls you shot at, what would you range them at, or what would you guess that they would be?
The two bulls that I did take a shot at, they were nice, probably close to 350, and they would have made me happy. I wasn't holding out for anything in particular. I knowing it's an archery tag, and I'm kind of one of those hunters that would regret not shooting anything, and you know, so I was a little picky at the beginning of the hunt, but as the couple days fell, I was less and less picky.
Yeah, I know exactly how that feels, and you're still a young guy. You'll get another bull tag. In the 24 years that I've been in Nevada, I've gotten one bull tag and never filled that tag. Got 103 yards from a bull of a lifetime, which wasn't quite as big as yours scored. Yeah, you go away empty-handed. You sometimes think, there's that old saying of never pass up on the first day what you'd take on the last day. But you still had some time, and you missed a couple of shots on a couple of bulls. Then what happened?
Well, then my help, I had a couple buddies that weren't able to help me anymore, and we actually came home. Reset, restocked, resupplied, and just my wife and I went all the way back up there and hiked all the way back up to the top and set up our spike camp again, and I went back after it. But I did lose about 3 days of prime rut season. When I got back up there finally with my wife, the bulls had quieted down quite a bit. They were bugling still, but very, very a lot less than what was there.
Any other pressure from other hunters in the area?
We did run into one outfitter with one older gentleman. But other than that, we had the place a lot to ourselves.
Well, that's because you went way up to the top, which not too many people can or willing to go.
Yeah, we did go all the way up and over, all the way from the Morgan Creek side over to the Green Monster side of that unit. We did a couple days with in excess of 10 miles, and I ended up shooting my bull about 8 miles from the truck, which was quite an adventure in itself to get back.
Yeah. So day of kill, morning or afternoon?
Well, I woke up as I normally would right before the sun would get up, get my coffee and my little meal. The bugling, like I said, was pretty quiet, and I heard him about 3 miles away, and he was pretty active, so I decided to run over there first thing in the morning, and I ended up taking him down at about 10 a.m.
Okay. Lead us right up to the shot.
So my wife wasn't feeling that great, so I decided to go out solo that day, and I got my water and my few snacks, and my bag was only 20 pounds, so I made the 2-3 mile trek across the open country to him, and I heard him bugling, and I decided to go after him, and I walked about 2 miles in knee-high sagebrush, and I didn't make a single noise until I got into some cover into the trees he was in, and then I started moving in on him with a variety of bugles, and I just kept working in on him foot by foot, it seemed like, sometimes. And
do you have any cows with him?
Not that I saw, but when I did get close, about 150 yards, I did see the rear end of a deer, and I thought that was going to blow it for me. The deer broke loose, and right when he broke, I bugled to kind of cover up his fanatic movement, and he stood up and started making his way right towards me at about 120 yards, and I had my bow with an arrow in my left hand, and I had my bugle in my right hand, and I just decided to drop my bugle on the ground, and it's still up there. I never went back for it. And I clipped my release on, and I stopped moving. I just stood right there, and there was not a lot of cover between me and him, but he didn't see me. And when his eye, I saw a couple aspen trees that were about 12 inches in diameter, and when I saw his head go behind those aspen trees, I decided to draw. And he hung up for about 2 minutes, and I had my bow at full draw for about 2 or 3 minutes. And he took a couple more steps and was looking right at me, and I shot him right down the front.
So you got him in the front. What yardage?
That was about 20 yards.
Good, clean kill?
Oh, yeah. I got the whole arrow back unbroken. I recovered it in the when I went to go to work on processing this elk.
Did it pass through or stay in the cavity?
It was still in the body long ways, parallel with the body. And he went about 60 yards and tipped over backwards, and I heard a big crash. And I was so relieved to see how it just go down so nice and fast, and no tracking needed. Just walked right up to him, and there he was.
A big relief, I'm sure, and no one there to celebrate it with you, though.
No, I was all alone.
Yeah, well, sometimes that's better. So then the work began. So you were, how far did you have to pack it? Back 8 miles to the truck or 3 miles to base camp?
Well, it was about, 3 to 4 miles to back to our spike camp, which where my wife was at. And so I had good time. I had him down about 10 a.m., and I just went to work with him and got his meat quartered out and all the cuts that you would normally take, and I got them all bagged up and hung in a tree, and I called Sage and Pine Outfitters out of Fallon, and they came up and packed down most of the meat for me, and I even left my bow there for them, and they were really good. They packed it all up and got it all back for me at a really reasonable price.
Oh, they went in on horseback?
Yep.
Good.
And I packed the head out, and I tried to get a small bag of meat out, but my bag was just too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I think finally when I made my trek back about 3 to 4 miles to spike camp, I was my backpack was probably about 120 pounds. I ran out of water, ran out of food. And I toughed out the last mile and a half with neither.
Well, worth it. I'm sure you felt relieved and rewarded by the time you finally got back. And now the question is, because I've seen pictures of the bull, and so did you score it at first, and then did you take it to a taxidermist? Or?
Well, honestly, I don't even know how to score. And so the taxidermist guy that's making a nice pedestal mount for me, he helped me roughly score it, and it has not officially been scored. Yes, he did help me score it.
And it scored what?
And right now, as it sits, it's a 389. You know, we guessed about what was broken off of him. His number five was completely missing, and that was maybe a 16 to 18-inch tine. And then he had a little extra on the same side that was broken as well, about a 6-7-inch point. But we guessed that he was probably about a 410.
Nevada has got some great bulls, and you got one of them. Obviously, he had been rutting and fighting with some other bulls in the area and everything. But even with all the stuff broken off, a 389 bull is still a bull of a lifetime.
This is my first Nevada elk tag, and after I've been archery hunting for years, I never could go back to, especially during the rut season of the elk, there's nothing like it.
During the cow hunt, there was no bull hunting during the peak of the rut in the unit I was in, but just, so we got up on a ridge and sitting above a bowl, beautiful bowl with the aspens and some clearing down in the very bottom of it and everything, and listening to five or six different bulls, one of them out in the open and the others in the aspen trees, is a big thrill.
Yeah, there's nothing. It's fun to watch. I watched a few big bulls fight bull after bull after bull. And, you know, we did have this big idea of chasing. I thought would have probably been the state record. He would have been well over 430, I think. I only saw him one time. He was really hard to get at, but we did put eyes on him. And it's having your partners that go with you and could be a huge asset or handicap when you're out there.
It sounds like that unit is filled with some really good bulls.
Definitely. I think I saw a few that were even bigger than mine. Yeah, they're out there.
Mike Orlick, he's the owner of Battleborn Tree Service. He's a sponsor of Nevada Backcountry. And you just got the bull of a lifetime. Now you got to wait how many years to put in?
I think 7-year waiting period.
7-year, that's right. Yeah. Used to be 5. And I was grandfathered in at 5, so I'm still trying to get that second bull tag for archery. So you got another chance at getting another bull.
Yeah, maybe in my mid-50s.
Congratulations, Mike, and thanks for coming on Nevada Backcountry and sharing the story with us. Congratulations.
Thanks, Jerry.